Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about Algeria. The country's struggle for independence from France was long and it was bloody, and it certainly captured the attention of the world. But once it ended in 1962, Algeria was mostly forgotten. It returned to the headlines again in the late 90s as a savage conflict between the army and Islamist guerrillas took the lives of an estimated 200,000 people. This morning, we'll be talking with Martin Evans from University of Portsmouth in the UK. His book, Algeria, Anger of the Dispossessed, tries to explain how the high hopes of independence turned to rage and led to a second Algerian war. The book is out now, and it is published by the Yale University Press. I also do want to mention that he has co-author on the book, and that is John Phillips, who reported from Algeria for The Times as a special correspondent between 1991 and 1997. Martin Evans is joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions of people who are listening are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that they keep their questions coming. It's brief, so we could keep our program moving along. But of course, callers are welcome into the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, certainly you have questions there. Welcome. Professor Evans, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
We can talk in great depth, I hope we will, about the wide swath of Algerian history. But just as a way of starting, I mentioned, and you mentioned in the book, the fact that there have been two times here in the post-war period when Algeria had the attention of the world during the struggle for independence and then during this roughly 10-year period from the early 90s to the early 2000s, and that the rest of the time, probably most of the world wasn't really giving Algeria very much attention. Then I suppose the question is, do you think that we have seriously neglected Algeria, and is that a problem?
Yes, I mean, I suppose really because it was an integral part of France. France invaded in 1830, and you had the long, bloody colonial war from 1954 to 62. For a lot of people in the Anglo-Saxon world, it's seen as part of really the Frank. It's part of a kind of. It's seen really as part of a French domain, North Africa. It really belongs to them. It's their issue, and I think for that reason, it's been neglected very much in both Britain and the United States.
Mm-hmm. I suppose it would be natural to begin with the point where the French took control, but I think that you would say, and I'm sure many other people would say, that one shouldn't somehow think that that there was nothing there before. Just for a moment, talk a little bit about the region before the French took over.
Well, it's a long and complex history. You have the original inhabitants that are referred to as the Berbers by the French and kind of, I suppose, Anglo-Saxons. And they've been there for thousands of years, and they really come into the picture, particularly during the Roman period in sort of like Roman chronicles, the Roman domains in North Africa. They talk about battling with the Berber tribes who have pushed back to the mountains in Algeria. So Algeria really comes into play in terms of the written record with the Roman period. It's known as the granary of the Roman Empire, and it's in this period, particularly on the coast, that you have Roman colonization. I mean, within Algeria, there's some of the finest remains of the Roman Empire in places like Timgad and Djamila. And then essentially after that, the crucial date really in terms of Algerian history, and I think it's important to remember that Algeria as a country doesn't exist, it's part of North Africa, is really with the arrival of Islam in the 7th century BC, the really dramatic rise of Islam after the death of the prophet in 632 AD, dramatically through from the Arabian Peninsula into North Africa, along the coast and into Spain, and that really is enormously significant in terms of Algerian history, the Islamicization of not just Algeria, but North Africa, which happens very, very rapidly over about a century after the invasion in 777 BC. Then really what you have is Algeria is a kind of like front line between Christendom and the Islamic world. You have Muslim Spain, and there what happens is that Arab and North African soldiers push into Spain and even into France in 732. They are defeated, and after that, really, you have this kind of confrontation between Islam and the Christian world in Spain, and sort of Spanish Catholic forces through the Reconquista eventually push out. They're referred to as the Moors in popular literature in 1492. At that point, what happens is the Spanish are then pushed into North Africa. The Muslims in North Africa call on help from the Ottoman Empire. And it's at that point, really, in the early 16th century, that they have the help from the Ottoman Empire. At that point, Algeria becomes an Ottoman province. At that point, it becomes virtually, essentially independent in the sense that the Ottoman bey in Algiers pays a tribute to the Sultan in Istanbul every year. But to all intents and purposes, Algeria is independent. It's at this point, really, in the 16th and 17th and 18th centuries, that you get the frontiers of Algeria defined, even if the people within Algeria don't refer to themselves as Algerians, but as Muslims, and it's at this point that particularly in Britain and even in North America, what Algeria becomes known as is known as the Barbary Coast, the Barbary pirates that attack shipping in the Mediterranean and into the Atlantic, and you find that what happens is that other powers like Britain, they're willing to pay a tribute or amount of money to the Dey of Algiers to stop this piracy.
Mm-hmm. The French invaded in 1830. It was a French colony for just a little over 130 years. And here what seems to be important is that it went beyond being a colony. It was literally a part of France. And a lot of French people moved in and settled there. And I'm sure that that rankled a lot of people in Algeria if they had had for some time this strong sense of independence and of their own identity. I think that there are, in fact, some people who talk as if the struggle for independence actually began in 1830 and not in the 50s.
Yeah, sure, because, I mean, what you have really at the end of the 18th century, the beginning of the 19th century, is the Ottoman regime in Algeria does enter into a crisis. It's sort of the decline of piracy means that the Dey in Algiers has to extract more taxation to the local population. You have a crisis, and really, for the French, if you like, Algiers is seen as an opportunity for Charles X, who at that point is a very, very unpopular monarch, but also for the army that want to rekindle the kind of like glories of the Napoleonic period. Algeria is seen as something, it's ripe for invasion. But I think it's important to underline that there's no real grand master plan for invasion. It almost happens by accident. France invades in 1830. It doesn't prevent the fall of Charles X as the monarch. So you have a new monarch who replaces him after the 1830 revolution, Louis Philippe. And they're not really sure what to do about Algeria. Should they occupy the whole of the country? Should they just occupy the coast? Should they even withdraw? Certainly, the way in which the French present the invasion, it's an attempt to liberate the population, as they see it, justified from Ottoman subjugation. But just because many of the people in Algeria were unhappy with the Ottoman regime didn't mean that they wanted to be liberated by the French. And what you find is by 1831, 1832, France becomes bogged down in essentially a guerrilla war in Algeria. Resistance is led by somebody called Abdelkader, and resistance is mobilized in certainly in terms of Islam. This is a resistance against a Christian invader. That resistance, I suppose, is really extinguished really by 1847, 1848. Abdelkader sort of surrenders. And at that point, and I think you're very, very right to underline this, Algeria is annexed not as a colony, but as an integral part of France. So that is the sort of why Algeria is different from the other parts of the French Empire that emerge in the 19th century. I mean, Tunisia is annexed in 1881, and Morocco in 1911-1912. But what is different is that they have the status of protectorates, that they have a status whereby the French are ruling in allegiance with a local kind of like government. But Algeria is different because it is seen as an integral part of France, in theory no different from than Normandy or Brittany. And indeed, I mean, the popular phrase was that France is divided by the Mediterranean, like Paris is divided by the Seine.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Martin Evans. He's professor of contemporary European history at the University of Portsmouth in the UK. And the history, contemporary, particularly the contemporary history of Algeria, is his major area of focus. He is the co-author of the book Algeria, Anger of the Dispossessed, and it is published by the Yale University Press, and concentrates in great detail on what has happened since the time that the country became independent from France, particularly looking at the kind of violence that happened over a roughly 10-year period from about 1992 until about 2002, 2003. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to perhaps to jump ahead, say right to the period right after World War II. Were people in Algeria, was there some kind of expectation that at that point things would be different?
Yes, I mean, I think what's going to be underlined, Algeria is an integral part of France. The other factor that's so important is that by the end of the 19th century, you have the arrival of settlers in Algeria, not just from France, but from Spain, Italy, and Malta. And that's the other crucial difference about Algeria, is this settler population, which meant that by the late 1940s, you had, roughly speaking, 8 million Muslims and roughly speaking about 1 million European settlers. And essentially, although it was not inscribed like an apartheid regime, you know, Muslims were treated as second-class citizens, and this was a great source of rancor for Muslims. They felt that they were kind of strangers in their own land. There was a huge amount of resentment over the fact that a minority of rich settlers had taken the rich land within Algeria. So Algerians were pushed to the poorest parts of the land in Algeria, and there were systematic famines, really from the late 19th century through to the 1930s. So there was this groundswell of discontent, really, amongst Algerians, resentment and resistance to French rule. And the problem was that the French, although they talked about assimilation and although they talked about the idea that France was part of Algeria was part of France, in reality, nothing was ever done to really attempt to assimilate the native population. So there's this huge groundswell of discontent. But I think you're right to indicate that really World War II has an enormous impact on the Algerian population. Firstly, the fall of France in 1940. It's a hugely humiliating event for France. It kind of shatters the aura of kind of like French invincibility. But then also it's important to remember the link with America, that in November 1942, you have the landings in Morocco and North Africa, primarily by American troops, and the arrival of the U.S., of American troops in Algeria is tremendously significant. Different set of values, which are perceived as less racist. Also, the idea that what they see is France again, if you like, humiliated. This brash new in theory, anti-colonial power, which is very, very different from France. And also the Americans bring with them the ideas of the Atlantic Charter. The Charter in 1941, Roosevelt and Churchill talked about the ideas of the right to self-determination. Churchill was very, very keen just to limit this to Europe. But Algerians saw that the implications, or certainly a political elite saw the implications of the Atlantic Charter, was self-determination for them. Now, I think really what happens in 1945, there is actually a huge uprising in Algeria, partly because there's this enormous expectation that the end of the war will produce a difference. The impact of discussions in San Francisco about independence, the idea that even possibly the British and the Americans will intervene to end French power. But what this comes up against is that France, in 1945, after the occupation, it wants to reassert its kind of like sovereignty, or its image as a great power. De Gaulle, in particular, felt very, very wounded by being excluded by the British and the Americans in terms of like end of war plans. And this is why, for him, it was very, very important at the end of the war to project this image of French unity. So not just in Algeria, but throughout the empire, there was a kind of like reassertion of French rule, but it's particularly bloody in Algeria, where there is a kind of like a series of demonstrations by Algerians that lead to bloodshed. In the area of Sétif, in the east of the country, there is huge repression by the French army. And, I mean, the Algerians talk about the idea of 45,000 dead. The French claimed it was never more than 5,000. British and American statistics talk about 15,000. But what was significant there was that Algerians were asserting their right to national independence.
The war, the independence war, begins in the fall of 1954, and certainly has the reputation of being of the independent struggles that took place in the 20th century, maybe one of the bloodiest, most violent, longest that took place, and certainly serious acts of violence were committed by both sides. Can you talk a little bit about the War of Independence?
Yeah, I mean, what happens is that in 1945, you've had this uprising in Sétif, and really from 45 to 54, although there are some attempts by reform by the French, these are never seriously applied. So what you find is from 45 to 54, there is, if you like, a drift to war. But what happens in 1954 is you have the emergence of a new nationalist force, if you like. What happened within Algerian nationalism, it got very, very bogged down and seemed incapable of confronting French colonialism. What happens then is with the National Liberation Front, it's a younger, radicalized generation of Algerians that want to confront the French state through violence. So this war begins in 1954, although it's important to underline there's no formal declaration of hostility. It's a kind of undeclared war, and there's a kind of like drift into an intensification of the war from 54, 55, and 56. And in many respects, the key date is 1956, because you have a French left-wing government that is elected in January. And although they talk about the idea of peace in Algeria, actually, after a visit by the French Prime Minister Guy Mollet on the 6th of February 1956, where he's bombarded by tomatoes, by angry settlers in Algiers, he decides to intensify the war by recalling reservists. And this means that by the end of 1956, there are over 400,000 troops, French troops, in Algeria. And their task is to the word that was used by the French was to pacify the country, to cleanse it of terrorism, which they present as being a minority, so that reforms could be introduced. What happens then after that really is a cycle of violence and counter-violence. It's classic, particularly in 1957 and 1958, in the capital, Algiers. There's a kind of series of bombs that are planted by the FLN in cafes in the autumn of 1956. So they're deliberately targeting civilians. to create a climate of insecurity which will force the French to leave. And many French politicians, they're shocked by this and say, we cannot compromise with these groups. And what happens on the January 1957, essentially, police powers are handed over to the 10th Paratroop Division, led by Jacques Massu, in January 1957. And they basically are given a free hand to eradicate the FLN in Algiers, and they use torture. People, I mean, as many as 3,000 people disappear. It's a game of cat and mouse, if you like, with the FLN in the Casbah of Algiers. I mean, all of this episode in particular is immortalized in Gillo Pontecorvo's 1965 film, The Battle of Algiers, that some of your listeners might have seen. Mm-hmm. So there are undoubtedly atrocities on both sides, and what this does is this actually leads to the overthrow of the Fourth Republic in 1958, the Algerian crisis, and the return of General de Gaulle. And de Gaulle eventually begins to realize that independence is the only way forward, and this is what happens in 1962. But I mean, it's extremely bloody denouement, because of all the settlers, the 1 million settlers leave. I mean, they leave in inverted commas to return in inverted commas to France. Many of them had never even visited France, and many, large numbers of them, have certainly not been born in France. Also, there are huge atrocities carried out by the FLN against pro-French Muslims, people who fought as auxiliaries against the FLN. They're left by the French, and they are massacred in horrendous circumstances during 1962. So, yes, I mean, certainly the Algerian conflict from 1954 to 62, it's one of the bloodiest and most complex of the large scale wars of decolonization.
We're in our midpoint here. We have a caller we'll get right to in just a moment, but to let me again introduce the guest, Martin Evans. He's professor of contemporary history at the University of Portsmouth in the UK, particularly interested in the history of Algeria. He is the co-author, along with John Phillips, who reported from Algeria for The Times as a special correspondent from 1991 until 1997. The two of them, the authors of the book Algeria, Anger of the Dispossessed. It's published by the Yale University Press. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana if you'd like to join the conversation. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. That's the number. We do have someone here to talk with, and someone on one of our local lines here in Champaign County where we are. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi. Good morning.
Yes.
I'll have a shot at it. I'm still stuck back on your idea that, or the implication I got, I don't know if it's accurate, was that somehow the invasion in the early days by France was some sort of accident. I don't know what word you actually use, but I mean, Egypt was attacked by Napoleon rather unsuccessfully, though it did accrue to his legend somehow. And there was an implication in what you said that maybe they thought they could use a foreign. But it seems to a foreign excursion as a way of domestic politics, or I don't know if that was accurate in my hearing, but it seems to me that one can't discount this noblesse oblige, or the idea that France, as a European civilizing power, had, you know, some kind of inherent right to expand its either empire or dominion or something. And I think there's a legacy of that in contemporary discourse. Juan Cole has the book out on Napoleon in Egypt. By the way, he's coming to town the 8th of March. So the other more contemporary question, and then I gotta have some chores I have to hang up, is how do you fit Algeria in the notion that's going around that when legitimate political opposition is secular opposition is demonized, that it forces the opposition into the Islamic, into the mosque, literally, and then consequently transforms the political reality such that we sort of create this Islamic force. This is a notion that's quite widespread, and I mean, Hamas was actually supported by the Israelis as a counterbalance to the secular PLO in the early days, much to the regret now, I'm sure. But so I don't know how you'll respond to that. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Mm. Okay.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think what I was saying about the invasion in 1830 was that the then monarch Charles X, it was an attempt to divert from an unpopular regime. And then really in the early days, the French didn't have some quite grand design that the invasion of Algeria or the invasion of Algiers would lead somehow to the establishment of a colony in Algeria, or even, if you like, more long-term, to some kind of empire within France. And certainly on the ground, the running was really made by the army on the ground in terms of if you like, pushing outwards from Algiers and then presenting Paris with a series of fait accomplis, which they kind of had to acknowledge. Although I'd certainly agree with your listener, that's in the beginning. However, I think really at the end of the 19th century, particularly under the Third Republic, which emerges during the 1870s, we do see the importance or the significance of, if you like, a universal civilizing mission. You know, the Third Republic, looking very much back to the French Revolution of 1789, and this is seen as a legacy or set of ideas that is not just specific to France, but is specific to the whole world, the idea that France has a global civilizing mission, and that means spreading French ideas, French culture, and the French language. And this is one of the reasons that Algerians certainly got so angry, was the way in which Arabic was seen as somehow an inferior language. It was actually treated as a foreign language for very many years in Algeria by the French. So certainly that civilizing impulse was a very, very strong one within Algeria, and has certainly left a very, very bitter legacy within Algeria. I think really the second point, if I understood the point that you were trying to make, in the Algerian context, it's wrong really to think about Algeria post-independence as being a kind of secular state. Islam was always a state religion. And the main effect of this, it means that, in a sense, opposition, or a large mass-based opposition, really had to come from within the religious realm. It had to come from the mosque, or particularly from street mosques that emerged in the 1980s. That were very, very much opposed to what they saw as a kind of like state Islam. And interestingly enough, much of the discourse within this kind of like street mosque movement was trying to take issue with the legacy of colonialism, the idea that actually what had happened during the War of Liberation was not liberation, but actually the French had allowed sort of agents of French colonialism to somehow infiltrate the War of Liberation movement and impose a Francophone culture on an Arabophone majority at independence in 1962. Now, I'm not saying that I agree with that, but that was certainly a perspective that was presented, and that was really one of the reasons for the polarization in Algeria in the 1980s and the 1990s.
Well, let's go back that point, because one of the strong points I think you make is that after this very long and bloody battle for independence that ends in 1962, when Algeria becomes independent, that at that point there was a great feeling of optimism, hopefulness, people that at this point that would be the beginning of a period of peace and stability and development, and this country would be very successful. And that what happens, and it apparently didn't take very long, is that particularly younger people, people who either weren't around for the independence struggle, or maybe were so young that they really didn't have any real memory of it or real stake in it, were very unhappy and became increasingly unhappy with the government and went looking for something that they could identify with, a kind of a political movement that, that they could identify with, and that turned out to be the Islamic Salvation Front. Perhaps you can talk a little bit about this key generation here, because I think that these are the people that you're really talking about. I think these are the people that you're talking about in the subtitle of the book, the people who felt that they weren't a part of the country, or at least that somehow they weren't able to, it wasn't going in the direction that they would like to see it going.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think really what happens at independence in 1962, and certainly at the time there was a great euphoria about Algeria becoming kind of pace setter or leader within the third world. In 1962, essentially what happens is the army of the frontiers takes power, and initially within Algeria, independence is difficult. Under Ahmed Ben Bella, there are a lot of the transition to independence is a difficult one. There's continuing unemployment, there's continuing social dislocation, and really the key moment I think is in 1965. You have a further coup d'état, which is led by somebody called Boumediene. And Boumediene really becomes one of the great leaders of the Third World. I mean, really, he's a bit of a forgotten figure now, but he certainly assumed the status of a kind of like Castro or a Tito. In 1972, Castro famously visits Algeria. In 1974... Boumediene addresses the United Nations on behalf of the Third World with a plan to redistribute wealth from the rich north to the rich south. Now, Boumediene dies in 1978, and you get a new leader of the country, Chadli Benjedid. Boumediene is perceived by huge numbers of people as being a great leader. Although initially he was sort of like unpopular, but certainly by the end he was perceived as a great, great leader. When he died, there was a huge outpouring of emotion. And under Boumediene, you'd had really the way in which the War of Liberation had become enshrined as a cornerstone of Algerian identity. Boumediene would emphasize that Algeria had not just defeated France, but, I mean, France was a NATO power. Yeah, he'd emphasize this. France was one of the great military powers in the world. Now, the problem is that Algeria, that what Boumediene encourages is population growth. And the result of this is that during the 1970s and 1980s, Algeria has one of the fastest growing populations in the world. But this new generation has a different relationship with history. It's not a history that they have no direct experience of French colonial rule. This is something they're only being told secondhand. What they want to think about is the here and the now, and they become increasingly cynical about the way in which this kind of public official memory of the war is really being rammed down their throats, and in their opinion, being used to justify the continuation of a political elite which they see as being increasingly corrupt. Now, really, this becomes particularly pronounced during the 1980s because Algeria is hit very, very hard by the collapse in gas and oil prices. So this younger generation really begins to bear the brunt of a social crisis in Algeria, which is exacerbated because in the mid-1980s, really, France essentially shuts its border to Algerian immigration. This has been one of the great safety valves, if you like, of the Algerian regime, the fact that people could be able to immigrate. So what you find during the 1980s is this younger generation is an increasing social frustration and anger at the regime. And for this reason, they begin increasingly to look towards the street mosque movement that I was talking about a few moments ago, led by young radical preachers like Ali Belhaj, and who are preaching the idea that that Algerians, if they want to make their country great, they need to return to the basic tenets of Islam, and increasingly the regime in place is derided by the street mosque movement as being agents of French colonialism, as being stooges and puppets that are continuing to try to introduce foreign ideas into Algeria, feminism, communism. So in that sense, yes, you find that really there is a huge sense of dislocation, which really erupts. And I think this is the key event, really, in post-independence Algeria, huge riots that take place in October 1988.
Back in the late 1991, this is a point when perhaps, again, to the degree that it hadn't come to the world's attention or hadn't held the world's attention maybe since the battle for independence, there were elections in the country. The Islamic Salvation Front won. This was the first round of the elections. And then the military came in, canceled the second round of elections, forced out the president, I guess essentially what we have here is a military coup, and sets up now this then 10-year conflict. Again, another very long and very bloody period where you have essentially you have the army on one side and Islamists on the other.
Yeah, I mean, you have these huge riots that take place in October 1988. In Algiers, as many as sort of 500 young people are killed on the streets. And for many people in the world, that's the first time that Algeria, if you like, has returned to international news since the 1960s. And people begin to realize that the country's moved on enormously and significantly since independence. What happens then is you see a movement towards some kind of a multi-party system. There is a freeing of the press. But the main beneficiary of this, as you've underlined, is the Islamic Salvation Front. They're seen as the main focus of opposition to a regime that's seen as corrupt, and they are poised to win the second round of elections, which take place at the end of 1991, the beginning of 1992. Although I think it's important to underline, in those elections, actually statistically, the biggest winner, if we can call that, was the large number of Algerians that abstained. They voted neither for the Islamists, neither for the ruling government with the FLN. But at that point in January 1992, the army moves in, and it's really a coup d'etat. And then after 1992, after that coup d'etat, you find that young, radicalized Algerians really begin to essentially take to the hills. They begin to form armed Maki groups in the mountains around Algiers, and they begin to prepare for what they see as a war with the regime. And that war really takes off at the end of 1992 and the beginning of 1993. And Algiers is subjected to utterly horrendous violence. Again, atrocities that are committed on all sides.
We are moving into about our last 10 minutes here. Again, I'd like to introduce our guest. We're talking this morning with Martin Evans. He is a professor at University of Portsmouth in the UK. He's professor of contemporary history and has written quite a lot about Algeria. He is the co-author of the book Algeria, Anger of the Dispossessed. It's published by the Yale University Press in the bookstores, if you'd certainly like to take a look at it. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. After this period of fighting, things now, after about 10 years, I think perhaps it was either a combination of the guerrillas essentially giving up or being enough of them had been killed so that they really weren't in a position to continue the armed struggle by the early 2000s?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, during the 1990s, there's a huge violence in 1993, 1994, and 1995. But the army regime has sort of like specially trained counterintelligence police services that become very well trained, well honed in defeating groups, particularly in urban Algiers. And what you see is that, really, I suppose by the beginning of 1996. These different groups who are not united, yeah, they're not united in any way. They have to be understood as very much a grassroots groups that are fighting from below. There's no overall unified command, in many respects, it's a deeply divided, deeply divided movement. And they are being pushed back. There's a lot of argument that the regime becomes involved in dirty tricks in terms of counterinsurgency tactics. It is involved in infiltrating many of these groups and actually turning these groups against Algerian civilians. This is the accusation, precisely to make sure that those civilians are, in the final analysis, alienated from Islamism. And particularly in 1997, there are a huge wave of massacres which take place in the hinterland of Algiers. But really, by 1999, it's becoming clear the success of the counterinsurgency tactics, also sheer fatigue and exhaustion in terms of trying to sustain this violence, which doesn't seem to have a kind of like credible political alternative for Algerians. So really the violence, I mean, it continues, but on nothing like the intensity that you had in 93, 94, and 95. And then at that point in 1999, you have the election in dubious circumstances of the president, a War of Liberation veteran, Bouteflika, who, although, as I said, elected in dubious circumstances, commits himself to a policy of reconciliation, an attempt to end violence.
So, does the Islamic Salvation Front still exist, or in what form does it still exist?
No, I mean, the Islamic Salvation Front is banned in 1992, and essentially what you've got now in contemporary Algeria are various groups that could be seen as possibly taking on many of its ideas. Although also many people would argue that the regime itself, in terms of its religious conservatism, what it has done is taken on many of the ideas from the feast as well. So I think the thing is that Algeria is a profoundly and deeply Muslim country, and that many of the ideas and arguments that were contained within the feast would still have a popular currency amongst the population, and the government is very, very aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps you talk a little bit about the relationship, particularly the relationship after 9/11. Between Algeria and the United States, and what sort of relationship, particularly the president, Mr. Bouteflika, has had with the, it would have been the Bush administration.
Sure. Well, Bouteflika is elected in 1999. The election is kind of accepted by the West. They see him as possibly a person that they can do business with. He is still very, very conscious that Algeria is a pariah state. I mean, they've won the war, or the regime can't be defeated. But it's a pariah state in terms of its relationships with other countries. And he is a veteran from the United Nations. He uses contacts and to try and get Algeria out of this diplomatic cul-de-sac. He visits France in 2000, and in that respect, he's very, very successful. But really, many people would point to the fallout from 9/11 was very positive for the Algerians on the international front. You know, the awful events of 9/11 happen, and then the Bush administration, looking around, and they're thinking, well, who are the people that we know who will have the type of inside information that we need to know about the groups that we're fighting against? And one of the, you know, instinctively that means that eyes are focused on Algeria. And in the fall of 2001, Bouteflika visits Washington. And I think the Bush administration lends support to Bouteflika, because they see that as certainly very, very important in terms of intelligence and inside information. So that means that when Bouteflika is re-elected in April 2004, again, some people would say in dubious circumstances, the criticism from the Bush administration is, you know, there is none. I mean, it is welcomed as a positive fact, because Bouteflika is seen as a friend in terms of the global war on terror. For Algeria, you know, the 9/11 dividend is seen as something. You know, they know that the United States wouldn't want the Algerian regime to go under in terms of giving them sort of financial and diplomatic support.
So I guess now what has become of the people that would have been supporters of the Islamic Front, the people who would be of this kind of dispossessed generation, the people who were born after the independent struggle, the people perhaps that would not be great supporters of the current government and maybe have second thoughts about close relations between Algeria and the United States. I mean, where are all those people now, or what kind of avenues for involvement in politics do people like that have?
Well, in that sense, I think the perspectives in Algeria are very, 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 very depressing. The arguments or the position that we had, you know, 21 years ago, the sense of exclusion that led to the huge sort of rioting in October 1988, those you know, the basic elements of the scenario are still there in place. You know, social and economic exclusion. I mean, there was a recent poll in one of the Algerian dailies where they asked young people, I think under the age of 25, if they wanted to leave Algeria, and the overwhelming response was yes, we do, because they sense that they have no economic and political future in Algeria, and that's exacerbated by the way in which politically Bouteflika has engineered a situation. He should in theory only have two terms, but the law has been amended to allow him to stand for a third term in the elections in April of this year. So I feel that the sense of disaffection is still there. The terrorism, would there be a return to the terrorism of the 1990s? I think that because that was so traumatic for Algeria, I can't see there being a return to the terrorism on that scale. Nevertheless, the sense of disaffection, I mean, I think is worrying, because within Algeria, you've seen increasing attacks on foreigners again, on Americans. There was an attack on the UN embassy at the end of 2007. And I think also there was the way in which the rump of the various kind of terrorist groups, a small minority, have rebranded themselves as Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. The reason they've done that is because they think that that will have a kind of like positive appeal amongst a younger generation. Whether that will happen, I'm not so sure, because of the legacy of the violence from the 1990s. People are still profoundly traumatized by that. But I think in that sense, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, they hope to build on this disaffection. Mm-hmm. I think alternatively, you know, whether we can look to social and political struggles, it's difficult to see how Algerians are going to express that, particularly if they feel that the elections in 2009 for the presidential elections again are just going to be another manufactured victory for Bouteflika. So I think the problem is that you still have a generation that feels very, or new generations that feel very, very, very excluded. In this sense, Algeria is a bloc society.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems that that's also something that this country shares with a lot of other countries in the region, and that is that they have significant percentages of their population that are young and that don't have a great deal of hope for the living a reasonably comfortable life.
I think that is the problem. I mean, I think it's something that both the United States and the European Union, you know, they need to think about ways in which they can address this in terms of promoting, greater democratic and open and transparent structures, but also how they can engage with those countries, not just Algeria, but Morocco and Tunisia, which you know, although the regimes are politically different, there are very, very many similar problems there. How do they engage with these countries economically? I mean, there have been initiatives in the mid-1990s. There was something launched by the European Union, the so-called Barcelona process, which is an attempt to to develop a whole series of cultural, political, but overall economic partnerships between the rich Mediterranean northern countries and southern countries. I think many people on the southern Mediterranean feel very disappointed about the way in which that the Barcelona process seems to have really stalled. It doesn't seem to have produced a positive economic dividends. And the problem in Algeria, I think this is probably something that also needs to be emphasized. I mean, Algeria is a rich country. It has huge gas and oil reserves. The problem with that is that oil and, you know, the hydrocarbon industries, which they don't employ very, very many people. And also the problem is that a small minority of Algerians are able to make a huge amount of money out of these industries, I mean, in terms of levels of corruption, with the result that governments don't have to engage with their citizens in terms of taxing with them. Yeah? They can, in a sense, ignore them. I think that's one of the problems within Algeria, which I think only exacerbates the sense of exclusion, because people think, well, we live in a rich country, which is, you know, sorted out its balance of payments problems, its debt problems. Why isn't that wealth being used to benefit a greater part of the population?
Just very quickly, we're very early in a new administration here. Anything that you have seen that would suggest what the policy to the region of the Obama administration would be?
It's in many respects, it's too early to say. I would say certainly amongst Algerians that I've spoken to that have got a kind of inside track on the regime, there are many people in the regime that would be unhappy about the prospect of a Barack Obama presidency, partly because they did well out of the Bush war on terror. As I sort of emphasized, there was a dividend in terms of a kind of international legitimacy which they used, and many people would argue that they, in many respects, exploited to the full. And all the things that Barack Obama has been saying about trying, as I understand it, trying to break with ideas, simplistic to ideas of a war on terror, what he stated about Guantanamo. I think in many respects, amongst the Algerians, you know, the real people in Algeria that have the power, those people, if you like, off the scene in the kind of military and in the kind of security police establishment, people that we've very, very rarely seen. It's not the public face of Algerian politics. But I think those people possibly who've been very, very good, if you like, sort of working with or exploiting even the discourse of the war on terror, they must be, if you like, slightly uneasy about the way in which the Barack Obama regime presidency could go.
There we have to leave it. Our guest, Martin Evans, professor of contemporary history at University of Portsmouth in the UK. The book is Algeria, Anger of the Dispossessed, published by the Yale University Press. Thanks very much.
Thank you.